Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of Inforum, a division of the Commonwealth Club by and for people in their 20s and 30s with a mission to inspire debate on civic issues. You can find Inforum online at commonwealthclub.org/inforum. We're co-hosting tonight's event with ArtPoint, and we're thrilled to have them as a partner. Now, I'm Ken Goldberg, and I know a little about art and a little about technology, but I have one advantage tonight, which is that I don't know very much about Impressionism. And I think that's an advantage because it will help me to share my ignorance, if you will, with the panelists who have much more experience, in particular Lynn Orr, who's the curator of the show that will open shortly. And what we're going to be talking about all began in 1863 when Edouard Manet painted a painting called Déjeuner sur l'herbe. And you know the picture. A couple of gentlemen sitting on the grass having lunch, and a very attractive woman without any clothes on enjoying the lunch with them. Now, the Edouard and the painters who came to be called Impressionists were rebels. They thrived on breaking the rules, breaking boundaries in a number of different directions. They broke the rules of painting and, in a sense, of behavior in general. That's why we love them. There's a major show that's coming up at the De Young Museum, and tonight we're going to get a chance to take a closer look at these troublemakers, their ideas, what inspired them, what influenced them, and what their experience may tell us about our own time. We also have the benefit that we have Pernod as a sponsor who has provided absinthe cocktails, absinthe was a very big influence. It's a powerful narcotic, as some of you already have experienced. And after the panel, we'll be able to go back and dip into that and just complete the experience. So tonight we're super fortunate to have three experts with us, really in some sense representing three centuries. Lynn Orr is a curator in charge of European art at the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. In some sense, she represents the 19th century. Ken Holden is a fine arts photographer with an expertise in photolithography, and he represents the 20th century. And then Heather Champ is an award-winning web designer who joined the Flickr team at Yahoo as community manager in 2005, and she represents the 21st century. So, to get us started, let's begin with some first impressions. I want to ask Lynn to set the stage for us. How did this all start? How did the Impressionists begin?
Well, in the 19th century, the premier art venue in Paris was an academy called the Salon. And in order to reach your audience, you had to be accepted by the art establishment. And the Impressionists were a scrappy lot, and in order to get their art exhibited, they either had to give in and conform to the rules and regulations of art at the time, which meant you did a lot of study from the nude, you idealized your figures, you did idyllic landscapes, and that wasn't really what they wanted to do. They were much more interested in their contemporary world. And you have to realize that at this moment, the middle of the 19th century, a whole host of technological innovations had come online. The train was a new invention, and it allowed people to go from Paris quickly. They could live in the suburbs. They could travel quickly out into the countryside. And a trip that used to take 4 days to go from London to Paris could now be done between breakfast and dinner time. And this allowed artists to travel, to see more art. Photography came online, gas lighting, electricity. Just their world exploded in every direction. And the agricultural society that had existed was totally dismantled. The aristocracy that controlled the economy up to that stage was displaced, and the middle class came into power. And the Impressionists were nothing if not middle class.
Hmm. Okay, so then what did they do in this context?
What did they do? They decided that they better band together because there's strength in numbers, and the Academy didn't really want them exhibiting with the, you know, beautiful idealized nudes and classical religious subject matter. So they banded together. They shared stories and studio space, and decided to have their own exhibitions. And they became independent, and consequently they were criticized and ridiculed not only by the Academy, the art establishment, but the press as well.
So why were they excluded in this way? I mean, what did they do that was so threatening?
Well, the Academy wanted to control the art market, and the Academy and the Yearly Salon, which was the government-sponsored yearly exhibition of contemporary art, was the only venue through which you could get patronage from the government, patronage from the church, and reach an audience, because there were dealers the way we know them now. There weren't private galleries that do small exhibitions. Paris art world was very closed and controlled. And so they, the Impressionists and their colleagues, were a real threat to the power of the government Academy to control the commerce of art.
Okay, good. So they came along and they started to break all these rules that were out there. And they picked up a certain kind of momentum. Do you think, what were the ingredients, do you think it was, that made them succeed, in a sense, as rebels?
Tenacity. Because initially there wasn't a lot of monetary reward for what they were doing, but they really believed that art could be created from modern times, modern images, modern people, and a modern technique.
Good. So there was a receptivity, in a sense, there was an audience for this. I understand that actually.
A minuscule audience.
Interesting. Okay, but yeah, obviously it had an influence. I mean, even Napoleon apparently was willing to give them an opportunity, right?
Napoleon III was the.
Was it the grandson?
Right. Napoleon III was forced by the clamor of the art community. Because so many of the Impressionists, including Manet, you know, who we think now is a god, these people were excluded from the 1863 Salon. And so there was so much unrest in the art community in Paris that Napoleon III said, okay, we're going to have a salon, an exhibition of all the people who got rejected. And that's where Manet, Whistler, a number of the people on the cutting edge of art at the moment got their moment of access to the public.
Great. So now for the benefit of for all of us, because we and for the radio audience, can you describe what did people see when they went to the Salon des Refusés? I mean, what was so shocking and different about the paintings?
Well, some of the paintings were bad because they were just by people who were excluded because they weren't very good. It's true. But what the audiences saw, and you have to realize that, again, this was the major place to see art. Once a year, the Salon put on these big exhibitions, maybe 2,000, 3,000 paintings put up at one time. The good paintings were hung on the eye level. The bad paintings, according to the jury, were hung, you know, way up in the rafters. And there are divine cartoons from the time of an artist with a telescope saying, see, you can see my painting up there in the corner. But at the Salon des Refusés, Whistler, whose work had been rejected both by the Royal Academy in London as well as the Paris Salon, he exhibited, Manet exhibited. So it was the cutting edge, the avant-garde, the artists who had a new idea about what was art and how art should be made.
Okay, very good. So now we're going to move. I want to get the perspective from Ken about the 20th century, because after the Impressionists, and we're going to come back to them, but after the Impressionists changed a lot of the way people thought about art, there it was in particular there was the role of photography. So I'm curious about your perspective as a photographer and an artist about how you think about photography and what influences the Impressionists might have made on you.
Yes, during the 1850s through 1900 and the early part of the 19th century, there was a tremendous amount of experimentation going on both in painting and in photography. As photography's invention in 1837 marked a significant change both in terms of technology and the materials that were in use at the time, created a landscape of incredible diversity and experimentation. As we've migrated through the latter half of the 18th century and into the 19th century, that evolution had continued and continues today in a variety of different ways, whether it's in traditional, what we call or term traditional photography from its inception through the modernization of the art form being digital technology today. The fundamentals for me as an artist rely on the roots of photography from its founding. When I approach a scene or the way I synthesize information is really based to a very direct link to the impressionistic painters that overlay as almost a latent image, if you will, in my mind as I look at interesting subjects to photograph. That evolution, both in terms of the impressionistic style, that is textures, simplified color palettes oftentimes, the way the light is evolving in a particular scene at a particular point in time, all come to play in a moment in a digital workflow. So although I was trained in traditional photography, which is the foundation, I think, for my work, I have exploited to the best of my capability the modernization of that art form in a completely digital workflow. The experimentation, I would say, is a catalyst for reevaluating and reconsidering the medium, especially in terms of the kinds of imagery that can be produced with minimal or no manipulation. Oftentimes, it's misunderstood that as a consequence of using a digital workflow, digital camera equipment, software, computers, that in some way detracts or diminishes the medium. And I would certainly argue with anyone on that point. But from my perspective, mastering the nuances of a software program or mastering the nuances of the software on the camera hardware, understanding the optics, all of these elements come into play to create a piece of artwork. And that starts from the inception, looking through the camera optics to capture a scene in a particular way, and then through the post-processing of that.
Are you telling me that you know all those different features on the digital camera, how they work?
That's wishful thinking.
I think there was some study that on average people used out of the typically there's like 80 different features, people used like 3. Okay, so coming back to the idea of photography, so photography when it first came out is really it's a machine, right? It's a machine, and the idea was that you could fix the image because pinhole cameras had existed for a while before that, but then you could fix the image with a process of chemistry, and it started to be used. What the early uses of photography were what?
Daguerreotypes were the most common, and that evolved to emulsions that had silver halide suspended in it, which coated both an acetate backing for film and then a paper backing for prints.
But I'm getting at the subjects. Like, what did people take pictures of?
Oh, I'm sorry. Right. So the most common photographic study of the mid-1800s to early 1900s were people. They were portraits. And occasionally some landscape work was also done. And then there was also an effort to capture the state of affairs in Paris with street shots and street scenes to really document the history of the city as it was going through this metamorphosis at that time.
Maybe I can jump in for a minute because, it's hard for us to realize when we're bombarded by imagery everywhere to understand what a transformation this was for people. And there's a wonderful letter by Elizabeth Barrett Browning to a friend, and she said, "Have you seen these new daguerreotypes? They actually capture the image of people." And she said, "But that's not what that's one of the things that's important, but what these images do is they bring up associations." And she said, "I want to have a photograph of all my dear friends." And so, again, it's hard for us to realize how important these technologies were and how transformative they were to the way people looked at each other and to their lives.
There was one interesting thing where there was a court case when there was a debate of whether photographs could be used as evidence for a crime. And there was a sense that this was the most accurate way of really capturing reality. And in the defense, on the side of the defense, the attorney went out and took a photograph at the Champs-Élysées in the middle of the day. And he presented this in court. He unveiled this with a flourish, and he said, "Look, and there was the Champs-Élysées, but there were no people at all in the middle of the day." And the answer was because everybody was moving. And so the image only took the things that were stationary. And he said, "We can't rely on this." So, and there's still interesting debates about the reliability of photography, as we know. For example, the cameras that are used for surveillance, they have to be a certain kind of format and a certain kind of resolution in order to qualify as evidence in a court. So there's all these interesting questions, I think, about the status of photographs and what they were, how they were used. I mean, certainly back in that time, if you wanted to sit for a portrait, your head had to be kind of bolted in place. And you had to stay there for quite a while. Okay, good. So we're going to come back to these questions, Ken. But I'd like to move to Heather. And so you're representing the 21st century and the future.
Okay. Bring it on.
All right. So, because you're a designer and an artist, and you're now at Flickr, and so I'm curious about how the status of photographs are changing, in your opinion, in the 21st century.
Well, I think what's really interesting, if we kind of step back and look at the internet in general, in terms of being yet another mechanism that's enabled people to sort of share their voice and their eye. So, in terms of, you know, before it was hard to get into galleries, now it's much easier for people to self-publish and share their photographs online. In terms of the sense of scale, I think is something that is hard to really grasp sometimes, just how much content is actually being produced. So, for example, at Flickr, we have roughly 3.5 million photos every day. So in terms of the scale, there's just a lot of content that's going through. It's kind of interesting if you think it from a Salon Refusé perspective. You know, there's the good stuff that you want to see at eye level, and then, you know, there's, you know, some guy who's sharing every single picture he took at a beach of, you know, the dog slowly moving down, and sort of the curatorial process becomes so interesting. But in terms of, you know, the ubiquity of it, you know, a digital camera now, it's what I find really remarkable when I travel is actually to step back and turn around and not look at the sites themselves, but try and get a perspective of how people are capturing those. You know, you just all of the people standing there with a camera, or even news stories these days, people holding up digital mobile devices. It's amazing. A lot of the Obama rallies, just you could see this forest of digital cameras being held up with everybody wanting to capture the moment for themselves. And it's just really remarkable, like, where are all those photographs going? My sister is sort of the memory keeper from my family. She's the person who actually has a fire safe, and the family albums are in the fire safe. You know, a lot of people have albums, and people wouldn't be looking at those photographs. What's happening now is you can take the card out of camera, upload those pictures, and instead of sort of a one-to-few or one-to-known, there's an opportunity for one-to-many where people can share their photographs with many people around the world. So it's not even your next-door neighbors anymore, or the people in your class, or the people you work with. It's, you know, some guy in China or somebody in India or people in Brazil. Like, there's this incredible global conversation going on around these images, which is really remarkable.
Does your sister, she didn't scan these pictures and put them on Flickr?
So this is a bit of a sore point.
Okay.
2 years ago, I was there for New Year's and spent an evening sorting out why she had 4 Flickr accounts and bringing them down into one and helping her sort of get her workflow set up. But what's really interesting, I think, is in terms of people embracing sort of sharing content online, comes down to what is the moment. So we see a lot of accounts created around birth, you know, like important family events. My sister works in museum education, and it was actually the Victoria and Albert when they had an exhibition of people taking photographs of art on beaches. Even though I'd worked at Flickr for 3 years, she goes like, oh, there's this thing, they're doing this project on Flickr, and I was just, you know, facepalm. And then recently, she was on strike for 85 days, and it became really important for her. She was sharing photos of her experience on the picket line. I was getting suddenly YouTube links from my sister. It's like, you don't even know what YouTube is. How can you be sending me these links? But it's how it becomes important to you at the moment that it becomes important. I think that's when somebody understands the need or the necessity that it becomes the spark that then they become engaged.
You know, I'm curious, you just mentioned YouTube, because there's a fascinating thing where the YouTube has suddenly created some sort of a new repository or archive, and it's really changing the way people are capturing memories. It's not just still photographs.
Right.
It's just as easy to capture a video. And actually now, if you have a camera at the end of an event like tonight, you go home and you upload, you know, all the photos, and then you have all the videos too. And then they all get archived. I'm curious about how you see video changing this landscape. And does Flickr have videos too?
We do.
Okay.
It's interesting because when I first started, I was really against it. I was like, oh, video, I don't understand. And then I was given a camera that allowed me to create video. And I was like, oh, so it's kind of like a long photo. You know, I like putting the camera down and seeing, you know, you get to hear the sound. You get a sort of a richer experience of what's going on around that picture. And it's interesting because it's still more nascent than even digital photography in terms of what it looks like. You know, something that comes out of a camera phone is fairly mungy, but it's still, again, the quality is going up, the price is coming down, and I think they're... Video's interesting because people need to think about it a little bit more than a photograph. A photograph is easy to digest. One of the women I work with has 3.5 hours of wedding video, and she's never watched it. Who's ever going to watch the 3 hours of the wedding video? So when we incorporated video onto Flickr, we did so with a 90-second limit because we really felt like if you couldn't tell your story within that 90 seconds, so we were enforcing a constraint. What is interesting is when we launched it, we thought people would be upset about that. We didn't realize, though, that there was a whole section of our community who was up in arms that we actually allowed video at all, because to them, Flickr had become this, oh, it's all about still photography. And so that was really interesting to have sort of this communication coming back from the community in a way that we never expected. But YouTube is interesting because it's cast such a broad shadow across the internet about, you know, what is video in terms of there's a lot of the Daily Show or bits and pieces, and you know, there's yet another hit, that Hitler movie that keeps getting redubbed with different language across the bottom, and
Lenny Riefenstahl, or
no, I can't, oh, it's the name escapes me, but it's, you know, it's interesting, it's so it's you can have longer
oh,
videos.
Oh, Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm just guessing.
I don't know. I just, you know, YouTube, I end up watching like otters holding hands. Or last week I was really enamored with, there's a Siamese cat who rides a Roomba around in the dark and his eyes are glowing, and it's animals. Videos about animals and babies is really...
Yeah, okay. So I'm curious, is there a... Is there a category of new things that people are capturing that is causing a bit of a sensation? Are there kinds of photographs that upset people on Flickr? Without going to the obvious.
It's interesting. It's when you have a global community, many different kinds of people bumping up against one another. There's always going to. Everybody has a set of personal boundaries of what upsets them, and so it's, is something too graphic, or is it inappropriate, or does it represent homosexual love, or different people have different boundaries and. It's just interesting to see when people trip over that and how they respond to it. We really want to be as inclusive as possible, so we have a rating system so that people can share their content respectfully. With any online community site, though, there are a lot of people who expect you, to be judge, jury, and executioner and sort of start deleting content that they don't like. And so I think what's most interesting, though, is being truly global, seeing beyond what the media is seeing you in news stories. So, photos coming out of Thailand, demonstrations, photos that were coming out of Iran last year, that kind of thing, that there's this incredible unmediated stream of content that I think is people who actually, you don't have people who are going there to document who aren't necessarily from those regions. You have people who actually live there, live that life, know what's interesting and want to share their view of it. And I think that's a much more rich experience than people who may be parachuting in to try and document something without understanding really what they're seeing.
And getting back to the Impressionists, one of the things that you can do on Flickr, I understand, is you can curate your own shows. You can
make a set, so it's like an album. So you could put together a set of photographs around, however you want to group those photographs or photos and video.
Great. So there's no real barrier to entry. You can just say, here, I'm curating a show, and I can put this online, and anybody can get access to it from anywhere in the world.
On a good
except
day,
China.
Yes. It comes and goes. It's interesting. Governments are fickle. Sometimes they decide they don't want for people to see things around certain anniversaries of dates. So we start seeing, image servers being blocked around anniversaries of things. But it comes.
Heather, I have a question.
Yes.
As the impressionistic painter struggled, to gain gallery acceptance to show their work, in today's technology on Flickr or YouTube or other website venues, how does an individual target a specific audience given the globalization and the proliferation of the technology to reach specific individuals given the plethora of images that are available?
It's interesting because we'll have people who – we have a help forum and people show up. It's like, I've uploaded all my content and nobody's looking at my photographs. Why isn't everybody coming to see my photographs? And you really it's really you need to engage with the community. So it's something where, put up your photos, find like individuals. You start engaging in conversation. What's really important is all of the metadata that you associate around your photographs, like titles, descriptions, tags, geolocation information. The more you enrich your content, those are different ways that content can come back, either through online search. A lot of that stuff is getting picked up faster and faster by all the various search companies now. So if you have really accurate metadata or
tags
and things like that, then that can enable people to find your content if they're looking for it. But in terms of any community, you're only going to get sort of what you give. And so you need to sort of participate sort of within that community.
So one thing that hasn't changed in all these years is that artists still want to be loved. I mean, they want attention and they want somebody to see their work. Lynn, let me ask you, because your PhD work was in 17th century art, and I was curious about, just to step in from that context, the technology of that time was the telescope and the microscope, and did that have influence on art?
It absolutely did. There was a new conception of space, distance, linear perspective, atmospheric perspective. Really changed the way artists made pictures and the type of space they represented in their pictures.
So you have the telescope influencing the 17th century, and you have the camera influencing the 19th century. From a curator's perspective, and maybe it relates to what Heather was talking about, how do you see the 21st century, the digital photography, influencing the role of art?
Well, I think Ken should answer that question.
All right, we'll ask him next.
Right. I think each artist is affected by his times and what he has access to. And today, artists have access to such a wide range of different experiences, you know, coming through the web, going to exhibitions. I mean, I don't see that it's really changed substantially the method of, you know, taking in experiences, images, and giving back art.
Ken, is she right?
Of course she's right.
Never insult a curator.
No, I would add that, again, you know, digital photography or photography is just a medium. And for the artist can select a variety of different mediums to work in. For myself, I'm using photography. I've used film-based equipment as well as digital. Today I'm using all digital, and for a specific reason, and that's because from everything I've read, including my own experimentation, for small format cameras, digital photography is a superior form to work in than film. That gives me new opportunities. For example, shooting in extremely low-level light situations that would not be available without flash and film. The extended range in the color gamut that's available in papers. Being able to calibrate my color space across all the devices. That means the camera software, the computer software, the monitor, the printer, the inks, and the specific paper that I'm being used for output. The technology is an enabler in a variety of different ways, and that can be exploited on an individual feature base. I don't use all of the features, nor the 50,000 Photoshop filters that may be available, or other applications. I do use very specific features in each of the devices that I use to tailor from inception in my mind to the finished artwork.
This is Lynn, and I'd just like to add, in the 19th century, I think that the coming of photography really liberated painters, because now there was a way to do reportage, you know, really represent things as they seemed to be, and that liberated the artist to go a different direction, to do things that were more impressionistic, more expressionistic, more, that the technique of painting didn't have to be totally, trying to represent exactly what you see in front of you, but to do something else.
Let me give you an example of what I've done recently. I've created a new body of work, which I call the De Young Museum Project, which I started January of 2008. And I decided in 2005 to do this project, so I waited 3 years to start it. And I made a commitment to go every single week, every Saturday. So I did, 52 weeks without missing a week. Then 2009 rolled around, and I continued. So 108 weeks went by, and I was just mesmerized by the types of images that I was photographing within the De Young Museum. I'd say 95% of the photographs are taken from the inside of that building. I'm still continuing to go to the De Young, and I just completed a residency there where I was going almost every day to shoot. The consequence of that was I've completed over 120 weeks, right? I've shot in 28 consecutive months, and I've shot over 60,000 photographs from that one building. Now, one may say I'm slightly insane, but I think with the impressionistic painters, it's akin to the masters of Impressionism, where they took their canvases out into the field and they would paint for 10 to 15 minute intervals and switch canvases. Why? To record the change in lighting and weather conditions and its effect on their subject. I was doing the same thing. I was known as the Saturday guy at the De Young, essentially a nomad walking around in a continuous loop, revisiting time and time again the exact same location and observing the dynamic within my field of view throughout the museum.
Just to put that in perspective, yeah. Ken, 60,000 photographs that took you approximately 2 years to collect represents about, on Flickr, about 8 seconds worth of Flickr time. Okay, good. So I'm curious about, so the location, one of the big things that happened on Impressionism was that the subject matter changed, the location of where you made art changed. Do you, Heather, see that also change in this, in the context of the Flickr photos? For example, now one thing you have is oftentimes GPS information that's coming up. So how is that changing the way photographs are both taken and then also searched for or tagged?
I typically now, like before I travel, I'll go and look on Flickr on maps for that region. Like, what are the things that I really want to see? Or, you know, beyond what I'm seeing in a glossy book, what do things really look like? Or we went to Hawaii recently and we kind of, you know, here's what the hotel wants you to see, what it looks like, but here's really what the hotel looks like from somebody who was there 3 weeks ago. So it's there's an incredible sort of opportunity to go beyond sort of the mediated view or the sort of the presented view to sort of what people are really seeing within a really recent period of time. Or now, you know, given that it's over 6 years old, you can start seeing how does time build in terms of, you know, what's going on around a certain thing. Like an example is, so the Banksy murals that went up around San Francisco some point about a week ago, when I heard about the first one in Chinatown, I went up before work on last Friday morning to take a picture of it. It's interesting, I went back a couple of days ago and there had been some horrific thing that had been painted to one side of it and somebody's covered the doctor image with a piece of plexiglass. And so then I actually went to Flickr and started looking, and there's so many people going through and photographing that, you can start seeing over a week what's going on in those spaces. So now we have time in terms of what's going on with photographs. And that's really interesting as well in terms of documenting change. So you're talking about, you know, how does light look over, you know, sort of in these increments, you know, sort of with the haystacks and all of that. We start seeing in places, you know, what's going on, how is the landscape changing. I've been going to Fort Funston with my dogs every weekend, and I was looking back recently at photographs I took like 4 years ago. The change of the beach, the sort of what's going on with the erosion at Fort Funston, it's very distressing in terms of the amount of erosion that's going on. So I think time is really interesting as well, sort of as a...
You know, it's interesting because you have this great encyclopedic repository on Flickr, and a friend of mine had this idea. He might have already implemented it, but that imagine that you would just have an applet on your iPhone, and when you went around, instead of carrying a camera or even trusting the bad camera on your phone, you just press a button, say, take a photograph here. And you wouldn't aim it or anything. You just press a button, say. And then when you came back from vacation, all those locations would be indexed into photographs that somebody else took in that location. So you get a whole photo album of your vacation, even though you didn't have to take any photos.
Well, but a friend of mine went to Hawaii about 6 years ago and lost her camera and was so distraught when she came back, she actually curated her trip through other people's photographs. Mm-hmm. And she eventually got her camera back, but there was this short term, she found like, this is where I went, and so it was her Hawaii vacation mediated that way. So it's there is one of the applications where you can click photos taken nearby. And
right.
Before I moved to where I live now, I suddenly realized I was seeing the inside of the apartment next door, and it was very disturbing to me, sort of. And it was somebody's birthday party, but it was like so close to the geolocation information. It felt a little voyeuristic.
Heather, you mentioned the mediated view, and I think that was one of the things the Impressionists were trying to get away from, that the rules of art were mediating everything. You know, all of their pictures of people, of the landscape. Everything had to be made into art with a capital A, and the Impressionists were really about responding directly and personally to what was in front of them.
I want to take up this question about what you just said, Lynn, and I also want to note that we're going to be taking questions from the audience in about 5 minutes. So if you have questions or think up some good questions, please come up to the microphones, which are near the front, and we'll be taking those in just 5 more minutes. Lynn, I want to come back to the very name Impressionist. There was something about this idea of the impression, the sort of subjectivity. Can you say a little more about that in the context of the contemporary things we're talking about?
Well, the name Impressionism came from a witticism in the press after one of the first Impressionist group shows. And Monet himself had done a quick sketch out in the outside of the harbor of Le Havre in Paris, and along the French coast. And so one of the cartoonists said, you know, oh, he's making an impression. And so that's how they got their name. But it's all about spontaneity and response to what you see in front of you, just a quick vision. And I think it relates back to what photography could do after the technology developed it a little bit so that you could actually get a snapshot.
Ken, what do you think about, do you work spontaneously?
Very much so, of course. To me, this overlay of French Impressionism, I relate directly to painting, and that painting style is running like a film on the surface of my mind as I'm viewing a scene through the camera optics. And what's fascinating to me is that Impressionism can teach us really how to enjoy life in such an extraordinary way. Why or how? Just to slow down and observe your surroundings. And this kind of micro-slicing of time has an extraordinary effect to witness the most subtle changes that are occurring if we just stop. I think, you know, on the Flickr side of the world, you know, and in our society today, that technology is so pervasive and our attention span is incredibly short. When was the last time anyone spent 60 seconds looking at almost anything? It's almost a struggle to stand and observe one object for 1 minute. In that context, of course, the images are, at least from my point of view and the work that I do, are very fleeting. They're momentary. They're instant. And oftentimes on the technology side, even though I'm using the most advanced camera equipment, it fails to autofocus in the time that I need it to. I'm often photographing through transparent media like window panes or plastic sheeting or something that is not allowing the camera optic system, the autofocus system, to detect the beam and set the focus distance. So there are all of these things that, you know, that they're both technical, and then there's also the lighting element that come into play that are all instant, and then they're gone.
I might just interject. The average museum visitor spends about 20 seconds in front of an artwork before they go on to the next image, the next artwork.
It's interesting because a friend of mine said that there's never been an invention that saves time. And if you think about digital cameras, right, they make it much easier. You don't have to take the film to the developer and get it back and all of this thing. But what you end up doing is you take lots more images, and then at the end of an event, you have to go through and upload them and then, you know, delete all the bad ones and fix the red eye and everything. It takes a lot more time in the end than it would otherwise. I want to mention just before we finish that this book is Art and Physics, written by Leonard Schlain, who's my late father-in-law, is a wonderful reference on these topics. It's a book where he looks at parallel, what he calls visions, parallel experiences and developments within both art and physics. And he has a number of chapters about the Impressionists and how one of the things that I'm very interested in here, and you mentioned the brain, Ken, is that actually the camera revealed a kind of distortion in our own perceptions. Because when you would take a photograph and there was something up close, you looked at the photograph, it was suddenly much bigger than we see it. And what people started to realize was that that was truth. That was really what was happening optically. But our eyes correct for all these things and set the world back into a new kind of stability. So it was really a way of changing the sense of knowing and epistemology. So, Heather, how do you think that flicker is changing epistemology?
You did have some absinthe, didn't you?
I'm going to have some very soon.
So we maybe think of it as one community. It's not. It's many communities, and I think. I think what's important to remember is that it really comes down to individuals with people who are sharing their individual views. Like there isn't just one view. Like there's so much, and it's so interesting when you start, if you find a touch hold and go through and start seeing sort of what the narrative is between that. It's hard. I think it's impossible to say like the one thing, but I think it's really interesting to sort of follow individuals and see what their path is. You know, there's what I think is really interesting is individuals who've definitely started out as enthusiasts with a pointitude who've graduated to digital SLR and are maybe going even from being enthusiasts now to, you know, making a living from selling photographs. So that's a really interesting path to go on. I don't have a good answer for your question.
Well, it's interesting because I think one thing is we have a new way of recording our world, right? And we have lots more data. And so one of the things that's going to be interesting in the future is as all these things are geotagged and auto-tagged for various, soon machines will be able to identify individuals within photographs and things like that. We'll be able to statistically analyze these patterns, not just from the elites, those who are lucky enough to get into the museum, but also the everyone and what they're taking images of and it'll give us a new picture, I think, of ourselves as societies. Okay, so we're done with this phase of the conversation, and now we want to open it up to you. And as a reminder to our audience, this program is presented by the Commonwealth Club's In Forum with ArtPoint. And tonight we're hosting Impressionism, Game Changers and Boundary Breakers. I'm Ken Goldberg, artist and professor of engineering at UC Berkeley. So we're ready for our first question. We have one. Perfect. Where is the... Is that the mic? Oh, there's one right over there.
Hi, I'm Jeremy. And first of all, congratulations. It's been an absolutely fascinating discussions. Really interesting. The question I have is, I guess, primarily for Lynn historically. I think what's one of the fascinating things is the interaction with the Impressionists between these artists and their experimentation with the technology of the day. And, I'm aware, and I'd love to hear your comments about the changes in the nature of paint at that time and the ability to have portable paint, the nature in the changes in the nature of colors available with the chemistry colors that were available and how they impacted them. But one thing that I really wonder about and is very relevant to this discussion is, in fact, the impact of photography. I've seen, the books, with Degas' photographs and, David Hockney's analysis of the camera obscura going into photography. But when it comes to, the Monet and Renoir, I've not really been aware that, they were specifically influenced by photography. And I'd be very interested to hear historically, indeed, whether they were and how.
Well, you've asked a number of questions. And let me just say that by the middle of the 19th century, the collapsible paint tube had been developed. So that allowed artists to grab their paints and go out into the landscape. And there was also a different types of paints because of the development of aniline dyes. So synthetic colors were created. So artists didn't have to actually grind the minerals and create their own paints. And because paint became mass produced, there was a consistency in color. And there were also advances in technology of the perception of color and the whole idea of primary, secondary, complementary colors also was very much a part of their technical approach to the application of paint. And yes, they did use photography from time to time.
Thank you. Okay, so we have a lot of questions. So we'll go over to this side, take one from here.
Quick question. When we started a discussion, you talked about the gallery and the Impressionists trying to get their works presented to the public so people could see it. And then we continued into today's day and age with YouTube and Flickr, where you have a lot of meta tag data. Is the quality of the art in the art itself, or the value of the art, is it the art itself, or is it in the distribution of the art and getting the mass public to accept that art? Mm.
Yeah, let's let Ken answer and take that one.
I'll pass. No, I think that, this would be a better question for Lynn to answer, I think. You know, from an artist's point of view, of course, we want our artwork to be accepted, both from the curatorial staff at museums, but also at perhaps the right gallery that would promote the career. The plethora of images out there is extremely competitive. And given that, then one has to think about the differentiation of their artwork relative to the masses and what the outcome is that the artist is looking for. So from my point of view, answering this question is an ongoing struggle, I think it is for most artists, until an artist reaches a certain stage of notoriety and success.
One of the things that's radically changed cinema recently has been 3D. So Avatar and all those things.
Right.
And I'm curious, do you think there's going to be an interest in 3D photography, or is that going to become the new wave?
So it's interesting. We actually have a few pairs of 3D glasses at the office because we'll infrequently stumble across somebody who's uploading 3D photography, and we want to actually see what it looks like. So it's there. It's definitely a very fringe sort of thing, but, you know, there's, you know, different ways that people are doing it. But I think what's really interesting is we began with talking about the Salon Refusé, and sort of these people are sort of the giants now, but at that point, mm-hmm. Was it art? I think the question still is, what is art? And that's still the thing that keeps getting asked through from time to time to time, sort of, what is it? Who decides if this is art or not? And what we decide, today, 200 years from now, how will that differ?
But quality is never in the technique or the medium. The quality or the art of something is the ability of an artist to instill in it expression, mood, value, and to give it his piece of art a voice that speaks universals across time, across cultures. So it isn't a technique, it's what the artist brings and imbues his artwork with.
And I think one thing that happens in 20th century is it's also about innovation. So it's got to be doing something that no one else has done before. So if you're just reproducing, another Andy Warhol Brillo box or something like that, you're not going to get a show at the De Young. But if you do something just absolutely no one has done before, that seems to be a characteristic. Would you say that's true?
In part.
Just trying to figure out how to get into the De Young, okay?
Whatever you do, you have
show
to
show up every
really
week.
Well.
Yeah, go every week. Okay, good. Another question?
My question ties back to, and you actually used the word notoriety. And this juxtaposes from before when Impressionist artists, obviously they fought to be in front of the salons, but they were purchased and they got commissions to do work. Now today there's these communities online where people are able to take these images easily. There's a notoriety of those artists back then. Today, do you feel like there's a diminishment in a way of the notoriety of artists because it's so easy to borrow and take those images? Obviously, you have more ease of distribution, proliferation of your images. My curiosity curiosity is about the take of how you're going to show these digital photography, because it's so easy to share. Therefore, there's also a lack of notoriety of these artists because the ease of access to the art.
But I think the idea of notoriety is changing, though, because I think if you become involved in any community, there are individuals who are known. They're definitely, we were looking back at a site that was made 3 years ago using our API, and it was like the Flickr stars. And it was really interesting that they were taking metadata and crunching it and sort of, these are the stars. And so within our community, there's a notoriety of these individuals. I think it's within the community, absolutely. On a greater whole, usually something has to happen for it to kind of bubble up in terms of thinking about Jill Greenberg and her crying baby photos, that kind of bubbled in various sort of online communities in terms of how people were responding to what was going on. So Jill Greenberg is a photographer in New York who did a series of photographs where she gave candy to children, and then they got really happy with the candy, and she took the candy away and photographed them crying. And they're beautiful, heartbreaking. Parents didn't respond all that well to these photographs. or some more than others, but in terms of, is it art? Or there was a lot of notoriety. It got pretty ugly with sort of the artist having to defend herself and, is this child abuse and just all sorts of crazy. But that definitely, at a time, there's a sort of a notoriety going on around that.
As notoriety versus actually the artist making money off of their art in the day, because obviously there's intellectual property assigned to those that art, the digital photography, copyrights, trademarks, and I know obviously today you see more and more where it's actually voided by being able to be copy and pasted, unless of course it's actually been deigned or they've paid for the image to be protected, if you will. So I guess, I don't know, that's why my one thing is obviously...
That's a whole other panel.
Yeah.
The copyright panel.
No, it is interesting, though. You're absolutely right, because the copyright issue, right, there's a whole idea of authenticity, right? So, and that also plays into, there were forgers copying Impressionist works.
Right. But not when they first came online.
Right.
Well... It's interesting because I guess in a way the best way, once people start forging your work, that's
then,
probably
then
a sign that you've
arrived.
Made it.
Right.
Good. Okay.
I guess that's paparazzi of today.
Right. The forgers. Good. Okay. So other questions over here.
Hi. I'm a photographer myself. I photograph architecture and art. And I remember one day in France, I was photographing the Conque Monastery, and I was waiting for the light, the sun to shift and the light to come and hit the facade. And I remember a bus of tourists approaching the town, everyone filing off the bus, every single person had a digital camera, every single person experienced Conque through their digital camera. They walked around and took a million pictures, and then they got back on the bus and shuffled off, and that was it. And I kept thinking, this is amazing that, first of all, they're experiencing this site through their digital camera. Second of all, what are they going to do with these photographs? What is ever going to happen with these photographs? And it makes me think about Microsoft's PhotoSynth or something like that. Like, you can create environments if you pull it all together, but then we get to the copyright issue again. And then thirdly, not that these tourists are artists, but it makes me think about an artist and the thought it takes to create a painting and the color theory involved and how Impressionists don't use black, and there's all these theories about how to create shadows. And then you think about how long it takes for a tourist to take a photograph with a digital camera. And it just makes me think about what's the use of all these photographs and is there a difference between the thought process and the time it takes and the effort from an Impressionist?
Are you suggesting that 3.5 million photographs a day might be too many?
It's worth asking.
The thing that drives me crazy is they all have the stickers on the front of their digital cameras. I just want to stand at venues and peel those stickers off, like the ones like how many megapixels. That's the thing that really... well, we have words, right? We have a word that is photograph, and we have a word that's snapshot. So it's interesting how there are a different idea around a photograph in terms of,
That is a lexicon.
Yeah, so, that people think differently about it. It's... That is the sort of the people experiencing, put down the camera and actually look at what it is that you're at. And so how long did you spend there? And you're sort of watching light go slowly by, and these people show up in the bus, take the pictures, and go off again. Is it a game? Are people? Do you collect points? You know, it's like Foursquare. I just checked in at the monastery, took my picture, and now I'm off again. Everything is broken, though. We have no time to do anything. Everybody, you were saying, you know, people don't do anything for 60 seconds anymore, and it's just like, you know, you're going to see 25 countries in 3 days, and it's, you know, it's all part of the craziness.
Now, unfortunately, you mentioned time again. We are out of time. And I apologize to those who still have questions, but I encourage you to come up immediately afterward. I was a little worried if we'd have enough material to talk for an hour, but obviously that didn't turn out to be a problem. We didn't even get to answer the question, what is art, or how has there's many more on this list, but one of our things we've done here in it's a tradition this year is to ask all the speakers one question before we conclude, which is what is your 60 second idea to change the world? So, Lynn?
Well, I think I'll deviate from art then, and this isn't something I dreamed up, but I think the most important thing is to be active, get engaged, and a value is not a value unless you act on it.
Nice. Ken?
That's tough to follow. I would say that forming individual bridges to other people to bring meaning and significance to their lives.
All right, Heather, it's up to you to have something that's really serious here. 60 seconds.
Less than 60 seconds. Mine is step away from the computer.
Yay. All right, let's hear it for unplugging. I just want to remind you that 60 seconds accounts for approximately 50,000 photographs on Sporker. Okay, on that note, I think everyone, we need to get back to the serious matter at hand, which is to celebrate these artists. The show that will open on May 22nd at the De Young. And we should do as these bohemian impressionists did. I think it's our duty to drink absinthe and experience what they experienced. Let's give a big hand to our panelists.